right, everybody, welcome to our next session. We've got Tyler Heston here to present The Symbiosis of Documentation, Description, and Pedagogy, a case study of East Timor mother tongue education. So please welcome Tyler.
Hey, thank you very much. So I'd like to talk today a little bit about how documentation and pedagogy can both benefit each other. And so a lot of times this is conceived of in the context of highly endangered languages and language revitalization. I'd like to also extend this idea to talk about how language documentation and pedagogy can help one another, even in vital language communities, using East Timor as a case study. But just a brief outline, I'd like to start off with where is East Timor, and talk about mother tongue education, what that is. And then at the end, talk about how documentation can advance pedagogy and how pedagogy can help advance the aims of language documentation. So got a map here of Eastern Island, Southeast Asia. We've got Australia at the bottom, Papua New Guinea at the right, or West Papua. So East Timor is right here. It's about an hour's plane ride north of Darwin. So to zoom in on the island of Timor, green represents Papuan languages, and orange represents Austronesian languages. So mainly Austronesian languages, but about four Papuan languages spoken there as well. So this is the area that's politically East Timor. We've got one island to the north, and then we've also got a small region on the Indonesian, kind of like tucked away in the Indonesian part of the island. So just some quick demographics and background information. There's about 1 million people in East Timor, according to the 2010 census. There's between 15 and 20 indigenous languages, as estimated by Hajek, probably more on the 20, possibly more. Still difficult to get an exact estimate of how many languages there are. But according to the Endangered Languages Catalog, over half of these are endangered to some degree or another. And so in between these 20 or so indigenous communities, people generally use the language Tetundili, which is a Austronesian language. It's been claimed to be a Creole, although not necessarily. There's been some new research on that maybe it's not necessarily a Creole, but definitely an Austronesian-based language with a lot of Portuguese vocabulary as well. That's used as a lingua franca throughout the country. And so most people speak their own indigenous language. If they speak kind of in the country, they'll speak an indigenous language, Tetundili, and also Bahasa Indonesia, or Indonesian, or Malay. And then some people also speak one of the neighboring languages, language from one of the neighboring districts, and sometimes English and also sometimes Portuguese. So very high levels of multilingualism, historically. But just brief history, it's the involvement of Portuguese is because it was a Portuguese colony. Started in the 1500s, there wasn't a whole lot of Portuguese influence throughout the history of Timor, relatively minor outside of the capital. They were granted independence from the Portuguese in like 1974-75, but shortly after independence, Indonesia took control. And so Indonesia was in control for a span of approximately 25 years, during which time the schooling was in Indonesian. Which is how a lot of the speaker population, or a lot of the population of the country now, is familiar with Indonesian. But then there was restoration of independence in 2002, and East Timor has been an independent nation since then. According to the constitution, the official languages are Portuguese and Tetun, and the working languages, which are kind of like the languages that are designated as being practically useful, although not necessarily national languages on the same level, are English and Bahasa Indonesia. Okay, so to get into the next section, what is mother tongue education? So historically, basic education in Timor has not taken place in the indigenous languages spoken by the majority of the majority of the population. Typically, basic education has taken place in another quote-unquote majority language, so something like Tetun or Portuguese that's more widely known, but that relatively small numbers of the children in the educational program speak natively. And so this brings up the observation that it's difficult for children to learn to read and write in a language that they don't speak natively. It's difficult enough to learn to read and write in your own language, but to read and learn to read and write in someone else's language when you don't understand the concept of reading adds an extra layer of challenge. And also, if children don't speak the educational or the language of instruction well, it can lead to problems in schooling. And the government of East Timor has been noticing that there's been a lot of students repeating grades and trouble in school that can be partially attributed, or might be able to be attributed, to children having trouble understanding what's going on in the classroom. And there's also been, but at the same time as this, there's also widespread proficiency in Tetundili is something that the government wants to continue. If everyone only speaks their indigenous language, it makes communication much more difficult. So at the same time, the government wants to support indigenous language, but also wants to promote the national languages of the country. This raises the question of how to balance these local languages spoken kind of more in the country and the national languages and larger lingua franca. So proposed solution that they've been trying to implement over the last several years in Timor is to begin primary school in children's L1. So whichever part of the country they're from, whatever district or whatever language is used in that district, start education in that language. Teach children how to read in their own L1, and then introduce Tetundili gradually, first orally and then written, and then after this to introduce Portuguese, first orally and then written, maintaining L1 support at least until third grade. And so the goal of this program is, rather than switching students from their L1 to a majority language, the idea is to teach children in their L1 or in the L1 of the community so that they can gain proficiency in the indigenous language first and then maintain that proficiency as they add other languages. So rather than switching, adding. So some of the benefits of this is that children are obviously best equipped to develop literacy in their own native language, especially in communities where perhaps their parents might not know how to read. They're going to be much better equipped to learn how to read if they already know the language that they're trying to read. And learning to read and write a second language is much easier once you already have the concept of reading and writing. And all these languages use the Roman alphabet, standard English letters, more or less. So once you learn to read one of these languages, it makes it much easier to switch to one of the other languages. And I've got a quote here from Thomas and Collier, quoted in Smith 2012. And so this is one of the largest, at the time, the largest study of bilingual education to take place. It looked at bilingual education programs in the United States on a large level. But they found that when children were better supported in their L1, at the end of their education career, they also had a higher degree of proficiency in L2. So just introducing all L2 didn't necessarily have positive effects. Supporting the L1 along with the L2 resulted in a higher proficiency in the L2 eventually. Another benefit of this is that it encourages the connection between home and school. Because if the schooling is taking place in a language that the parents don't speak, it makes it difficult for them to help their children, or it discourages communication, whereas introducing an indigenous language program encourages parents to get more involved and better communication with between teachers and parents and the community at large as well. And another benefit is that it supports children's cultural and linguistic identity, even beyond whether they can understand what the teacher is saying or not. Even if you speak your own indigenous language and the national language at the time that you're entering school, it's still valuable to know that this is the language that's written, that people use in education, and it gives legitimacy and value to the language. This closely follows to the policy recommended by United Nations Forum on Minority Issues, which encourage, I've got a quote here, the idea is to have children begin education in their the language that they're most comfortable with, and then support them through the transition, if necessary, to learning in other languages, the languages of wider communication of the region and the country. So currently, the Timorese Government of Education is piloting in three languages, Fatuluku, Baikano, and Galolan, and also getting started programs in other languages. They're implementing this in the preschool A, which is 3 to 4 years old, preschool B, and first grade. So similar to preschool, kindergarten, and first grade. Plans to steadily add languages, and they've been doing some work on, Kemak and Bunak, two other languages. So Fatuluku is a Papuan language that I've been doing work on, and Baikano and Galolan are both Austronesian languages. So one of the challenges, one of the main challenges that they've been experiencing is developing literacy materials for these languages parallelly at multiple different levels when literacy, there hasn't really been any sort of tradition of literacy in these languages, but they're trying to develop primers and school materials and books and things so that once children actually learn how to read, there's something to read at the appropriate level for students at different levels in the education program. So trying to introduce materials for not just one, but three languages at the same time has been a substantial challenge. I'd like to talk now about how linguistics can help inform pedagogy. So one of the first ways is through phonemic analysis. So understanding the phonemes of a language is crucial to developing a good alphabetic orthography. And now there's more to developing a good orthography than just a phonemic analysis. But if you don't have a good analysis of the phonemes, that's kind of the first step to even being able to approach a good orthography. If you don't understand this, you can sometimes use different symbols for allophones or use the same symbol for things that are contrastive in the language that can make things difficult for native speakers. Here's some more, a couple of references here, some more information on orthography development. Another thing that linguistics can help with, another aspect of orthography development, is not just analyzing the phonemes, but also determining word divisions. This can be difficult for linguists as well, admittedly, but linguists have much better tools to be able to deal with these sorts of things. So for instance, in Fatuluku, I've been doing some work on serial verbs. And so there's serial verbs, such as like a verb that means to be in a certain location. And this verb can serialize together with an action. So you could say, sleep in or sleep on. But in this case, unlike the English construction, both of these are actually verbs. It's been a question of how to write these, and also like, are they one word, are they two words? So by looking at the intonation, looking at the word level prosody, been able to develop some evidence that these things are actually two words, which is helpful in making decisions about how to write them. Another great way that linguistics can contribute to pedagogical efforts is through the creation of dictionaries, especially in communities where literacy is just developing. Dictionaries are intimately connected with literacy, as Frawley et al. Point out. And in many cases, a dictionary may be the first or one of the first books or written materials to be available in the language. And while grammatical analyses are helpful in the long run to maintaining a language, it's not always immediately relevant to community members. They might not understand why they should be excited about a grammatical analysis or a number of theoretical papers, but everyone understands a dictionary, and everyone can appreciate the use and value of a dictionary. Also useful for the people developing primers, reading materials, and supporting bilingual, especially in bilingual education programs, having bilingual dictionaries between a regional or national language and the indigenous language is very useful. Documentary records can also serve as a basis for school materials. If you're developing materials, primers and basic reading materials, you can do things like translating common Western stories, and this can be a useful way to get material for basic reading materials. But if you have a rich documentary record, you can also use the stories and traditional legends and tales that you've collected, maybe from the elders that maybe the children aren't as familiar with, and use this as the basis for educational materials that can also make things more culturally relevant and more relevant to the context in which the children are living. Also connecting children to a little bit more to their cultural heritage. So those are a few ways, not an exhaustive list, but a few of the ways that documentation can advance pedagogy. I'd also like to point out some ways on how pedagogy can help to advance some of the goals of documentation. So one great side effect of the pedagogical programs is the interest that they generate in the language. In some language communities, I haven't experienced this personally, but I know in many language communities, linguists have expressed, going into the language community and people not really being too interested in the language, not interested in preserving their own language. But having a documentation project can raise excitement about the language, about its value, and about getting people interested in why what we're doing as linguists is valuable. It shows a nice, tangible outcome that the things that we're doing is actually going back directly to help the community in dictionaries and educational efforts. It encourages speakers that what they're doing, answering all of these questions about he ran, I ran, she ran, like doing this over and over and over again, like why is this useful? It can actually show them how this is valuable. It can also help with getting official clearance, and if the government's running a pedagogical program, it can also help us as linguists to be supported in our research. Another advantage is bringing about an increased role of native collaborators. And as a number of people have pointed out recently in a number of different publications, that collaborating with native language speakers, a lot of times native language speakers are better equipped for many of the tasks of language documentation than outside linguists are. So for instance, collecting narrative data and transcribing narrative data and translating it into a larger language, generally the speakers of the language are much better prepared at that than linguists. And having a tradition of literacy and education developing can also help to foster these relationships of interest in the community, in the projects, and participation. Another advantage is language conservation. So as all of you are familiar with, there's a large number of languages that are at risk of going extinct in the near future. But having this sort of mother tongue education program gives students massive exposure to the language at a very early age. And I mean, at the time a kid is 3 or 4, their first language isn't even fully developed yet. So if they've been having, not getting enough exposure to the language of their heritage, having a program like this completely in the indigenous language can really support them and really shore up some people who might be starting to not get, maybe the first generation that's not really getting enough exposure to the language to really learn it. This sort of program can really shore them up and help perpetuate the language into the future. And it may be also the fact that you're introducing the indigenous language rather than pushing students to a majority language also tip the balance in favor of language maintenance. Also, results in generating research questions. This is something that I hadn't really thought about until I started working together with some of the people working at the Ministry of Education. And they asked me some questions about how are these words syllabified, and it's something that I hadn't really thought to think of before. But these questions led me to, it just got me thinking about this, and now I've kind of gone a long way around studying a lot about word-level prosody and intonation. This helped me get back to their seemingly very simple question about how words are syllabified. So examples like ia and aya both have, like, the first one has 2 vowel sounds and the second one has 3 vowel sounds. They're asking about how to syllabify a word like aya. Is it aya or aya, which sounds somewhat trivial, but actually involves a question of whether this ya sound bears a more. Is it a vowel underlyingly or is it a consonant? So it led me down some interesting research directions. It turns out it's not a vowel, it's a consonant, in case anyone was curious. Okay, so to sum up, documentation and pedagogy are usually thought of as being linked in the context of revitalization, but hope I've been able to show that collaboration between these two fields should not necessarily be limited to revitalization efforts, but can also be very valuable even among highly vital language communities. So I've looked specifically at the mother tongue education programs being implemented in East Timor, though a lot of these concerns and the conclusions are also relevant to languages around the world. So just to sum up some of the benefits that we've covered, again, not necessarily an exhaustive list, is that documentation can aid pedagogy by providing phonemic analysis, tools for dealing with word boundaries, dictionaries, and other lexical materials, also a rich corpus of documentary materials. Pedagogy can aid documentation by inspiring interest in the language and garnering official support among the community and the government and other parts of the country. Also, increased role of native collaborators, helping to conserve the language, and even generating research questions for linguists to investigate. So, thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Tyler. We've got about 10 minutes for questions, so if anyone has any for Tyler.
Okay, so I've been in contact, and since I've been working on my dissertation, I have a lot of things that are half revised, but I'm planning on working on revising those up, getting those polished, and as I get some more completed analyses, sending those, just even before publication stuff, just sending those to the people who are working on the education program, and also maybe just giving them some summaries also of just kind of like some quick snapshots of, by the way, here's how this works in Fatuluku, and if that's relevant for the types of orthography development that they're doing. So sending them my materials, the publications that I'm working on, and also kind of summaries. Yes?
So in terms of the pressures contributing to language endangerment, what are the two languages that people are gravitating toward, Portuguese and then the Creole, or is there any of the languages that are sort of attracting people away from their indigenous L1?
I would say it would be mainly Tetun, the Creole-ish. And is that kind of what you've experienced, Melody? Is it mainly
yeah,
people going to Tetun?
Definitely Creole stuff. Yeah, there's a lot of pressure these days for English a little bit, like especially the young kids that really want to learn English, but it's, yeah, for the most part, it's all Tetun.
Yeah, when I was there, I didn't experience a whole lot of people with high fluency in English, but everyone speaks Tetun. The grandparents don't, but pretty much all the young people speak Tetun. Portuguese, not as much, so I'd say mainly Tetun.
What is the official language of education?
See, I'm not sure what the official language for education is. I've been reading up mostly on the policies in the mother tongue education, but they're trying to introduce education in both Tetun and Portuguese from what I've been reading. No, it's not. It was for while Indonesia was there, but still a little bit of bad taste in people's mouth. Maybe not necessarily for the language, but people are not quite as excited about Indonesian stuff as native Timorese stuff, I perceive.
Do you happen to know what the other
languages? See, I believe that they want to eventually branch out to all the languages. I know right now it's Baikeno, Fatuluku, and Galulan. And then I heard that they're working on Bunak and Kemak as well. Kemak's Austronesian, Bunak's Papuan. I believe that they eventually, ideally would like to cover all 20-something languages. But that might be kind of a ways down the road. Yes? I know while I was there, I got to see some of the first runs off the press and some storybooks that they're developing. There's been a lot of work to develop, but just kids, simple picture book storybooks in the indigenous language, which was really neat to get to see. Maybe some of the first books that had been developed in some of these languages. And I know that they're continuing efforts along these same lines to continue to develop resources, to try to develop, like you pointed out, the limitation of having a small things to read, and also raises the question for kids of, like, why am I learning to read if there's only three books that I can read? So it's something that they're actively working on, to develop more storybooks and to cover a wider range. But I think it's something that's going to take some time to develop a large corpus. Yes?
How much technology is used in this area? And has it been taken into consideration in the orthography development and in the language policies?
Okay, so I know that, like, a lot of the teammates, like, a lot of the young people, like, everyone has a cell phone. Actually, like, the cell reception was, like, better. Like, you'd be, like, in the middle of nowhere, like, on a bus, and you're, like, there's nothing except maybe a few huts and some water buffalo in, like, 3 miles in every direction, and you've got, like, 5 bars, perfect cell reception, get the internet. I don't know how they do it, but everyone has a cell phone among the young people. Most people, not so much computers in the, I think in the city, people, like, a lot of young people have access to computer technology. In the country areas, not so much, but a lot of the people there are on Facebook, at least the young people, on Facebook, using computers, so a lot of them are writing, like, I'm most familiar with Fataluku, so a lot of the consultants that I've been working with, they write Fataluku on Facebook, but everyone spells things their own way, and they spell things differently, and you have a conversation with them, and they'll spell the same word 3 different ways, 3 different times, so there is a lot of access to technology, which I believe would kind of lead us to want to develop things that are ASCII compatible without a lot of diacritics or things that would be difficult to type because people are texting and Fataluku has a vowel length distinction, but it's somewhat marginal. It doesn't distinguish a lot of words, but it's definitely there. But I'm proposing that we probably wouldn't want to represent that in the orthography, or might be easier not to, because even if you make the orthography and say that long vowel should have a macron, no one's going to use it, guaranteed, because it's just going to be, they're not going to know, like, when to write it, and when they're texting, which is probably how people are going to use this a lot, it's not going to get written. So yeah, that's a great point that, things that are maybe linguistically it'd be nice to have diacritics to represent different things, but yeah, because of the technology, where they use enough technology to be, that we want to be able to type it, but not so much that they're going to have, like, Unicode fonts on everything. So, yeah, good question.
So you're saying that people are attempting to write Fataluku, for example?
Yes.
But, so they're attempting because they're doing transfer literacy from Tetum, so back to Fataluku.
Yes.
So they've got enough of that. So there is this space where people are really using text and trying to encode and decode. So maybe that's an interesting area to be working in as well, attached to the sort of development of alphabetic text pre-literacy.
Yes. And yes, it's definitely kind of like happening organically. And I think also that the way that the orthographies are shaping up, there's a lot of similarity between the Tetrin orthography and the indigenous orthography, which is definitely, I think, the way that we want to go to make transfer as easy as possible between languages and also between various indigenous languages. Yes.
All the indigenous languages have teachers who are qualified to teach in the first grade in their native language.
Define qualified? Fataluku and I believe the other languages as well, Baikano and Kalolan, I believe they're vital. So there's, like, in Fataluku, all of the parent generation, everyone speaks it natively, fluently for everything. So there's definitely people who are solid enough in the language to be able to teach. As to whether they have teaching experience or knowledge or what kinds of teaching techniques and training they have, like whether they actually have any training to be a teacher, That's a separate question, and I'm not sure about that. But at least in the situations I'm familiar with, there's plenty of native speakers who would be available to teach. Just a question of how much. I don't know. Okay, so I'm getting the times up here. So thank you very much. And also, just like to wrap up with some acknowledgments to Jim and Carla Smith for the information they provided on this project and for their work on this project. And thanks to Melody Ross also for getting me interested in Timorese languages, and to Leo Lazario, who also was my first Fatuluku consultant and got me interested in Timor. So thank you very much.